Yes, that's We the People, also known as the Sweet Haven song from the movie Popeye. And that announces yet another edition of We the People. And this week, you may have already heard him earlier on the morning show. We have Robert Freeman, who is, let me set you up with your mic a little.
I got it. You go. Thank you.
Who is chair of, actually, what is your exact title?
The title is Executive Director of the New York Committee on Open Government.
So in this hour, I hope to go from the national to the local in some of the questions. We actually had some questions sent in from listeners as well.
Good.
But first, let's discuss the committee. The committee is composed of how many people?
The committee is, first of all, a state agency. It's part of the Department of State. The staff is myself and one other, Assistant Director Camille Jobin-Davis. We are the smallest state agency that actually does anything. I'll leave the rest to people's imagination. And the committee itself has 11 members. Four are gubernatorial appointees or elected officials. They include the Secretary of State, the Lieutenant Governor, Director of the Budget, and Commissioner of General Services. The governor also appoints one elected local government official and four public members, and at least two of the four must be either present or former representatives of the news media. And the leaders of the legislature appoint one public member each. So we have a total of 11. Six are public members, five are from the government. The reality is, though, that the day-to-day business is carried out by the staff.
When you say, so how many is the governor responsible for?
The governor appoints a total of nine out of the 11.
So it really does, and they all serve at his pleasure. I mean, he can ask them to leave.
By statute, four are ex officio, which means that they are there by virtue of their offices. Again, they include the lieutenant governor, secretary of state, director of the budget, commissioner of general services.
And what is... Now, do you have to account for yourself to the governor?
Well, let's put it this way.
this will be important.
I'm
in terms
on my seventh governor.
Okay.
And I have no protection.
Right.
Technically, yes, I serve at the pleasure of whoever the governor might be. But I have been exceedingly fortunate. As a matter of fact, what's today? Today's the 19th of March?
Correct.
The 21st will be my 41st anniversary with New York State. And I was loaned to this new office in August of 1974.
Where were you working before that?
I was at the State Department of Social Services, which now has a different name. I was only there for a few months.
Mm-hmm.
The rest, as they say, is history. And I have what I've considered forever to be the best job in state government.
Well, the reason I ask about the relationship to the governor is because, as you know, one of the pressing issues involves the governor and his attitude towards emails. But we'll get to that in a bit. What makes kind of engaged listeners and people in general these days is, of course, the national story. And I know you don't work on the national level, but, of course, the story involving Hillary Clinton and her emails. Now, emails, of course, are subject of much controversy in terms of, are they open? Do they have to be recorded? Do they have to be preserved? In her case, the issue was, how would you describe the issue or issues?
You know, in her case, a server was set up at her private home, and it seems that thousands of email communications either came and went from that server.
Both private and those dealing with being Secretary
correct,
of State.
Correct. Now, for what it's worth, and I need to provide a little perspective. Again, there's a federal act which applies to federal agencies. Every state has its own version of a Freedom of Information law. They're all different. Our law was initially passed in 1974. It was weak. And when we tried to improve it, we looked at...
New York, the state. Yes,
yes,
okay.
When I say our, I'll be referring to New York. We looked at the federal act and tried to correct what we believed to be its deficiencies. And one of the deficiencies which exist to this day, and it's become clear, is that the federal act doesn't define what a federal government agency record is. To this day, there are issues that percolate through the federal courts which involve who prepared it, where did it come from, what is its function. Those issues were all resolved here by 1978 when a completely revised New York Freedom of Information law went into effect. And I'll tell you how in a moment, but I see you have a question.
But in 1978, of course, there weren't all these new forms of communication. It was pretty much hard copy letters that people were concerned about. Right?
Well, yeah. You know, when I give a presentation and there are, as in so many instances, so young people, relatively young, you look at the 70s, high tech was an electric typewriter. Mm-hmm. We used carbon paper to make copies. Nobody dreamed of the Internet. There was no such thing as email. And often I use a prop. How do you have a phone without a cord? It was science fiction. But we got lucky. And it was the beginning of the era of computers. And in New York, since 1978, our Freedom of Information law, many people call it FOIL, has defined the term record to mean any information in any physical form whatsoever kept, held, filed, produced, or reproduced by, with, or for a unit of state or local government or the state legislature. So
that's the definition. Then the next step is to come up with a policy of what you do with those.
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
We'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
yeah, so if I go home and sit down at my home PC and use my private personal email address and communicate with you in my capacity as a state employee, that is a government agency record. It doesn't matter.
Hold on a second. Yeah. As a state employee, does that include if you're – I mean, it obviously includes if you're using your government email address.
It includes if I'm not using my government email address.
Right. But the matter has to be – the subject matter would have to be something to do with being a government employee, correct?
Presumably, But then again,
what if you're at home, you're a government employee,
yep.
We have a conversation about something that's not public information.
FOIL wouldn't apply.
Okay.
FOIL wouldn't apply. You know, and let's think about this. We're in Hudson, small city, small city. And this issue really sort of became prevalent when email became prevalent. And let me ask you, you would know better than I do. Do members of the city council have offices in City Hall?
No.
They don't. I'm guessing that they communicate with each other, with staff, with constituents in between meetings.
Absolutely.
Well, back in the olden days, they'd get on the phone, they'd have a cup of coffee. Now they do it via email. And our advice has been simple. Based upon that definition of the term record, if they communicate via email in the performance of their official duties, that is a government agency record. The next question, as you suggested, is, what's public and what's not? And, you know, I've had to go through this 1,000 times. Is email covered by FOIL? Is it always public? Is it always out of bounds? Well, you think about paper. And we think about the content. The content will determine what's public and what's not. Mm-hmm. Email is simply a means of communicating a record. What really matters is what is in the record. And that's how we look at FOIL.
Right. Now, let's say there's a conversation going on between a politician and a constituent. And at some point, let's say the politician says something personal as an insult. But it's not in that email is nothing about anything necessarily political. Is that insulting email a public? Is that part of the public record?
Well, was it communicated in the performance of so-and-so's duties?
Well, that...
I mean, that's the question, but let me again, just to
and that actually refers to something that's happened here in Hudson.
Well, I don't know what's happened, and you might fill me in, but...
let's go. Should we go back a bit to Hillary Clinton? Because I want to start big and then sort of end up in some local things.
My point, I suppose, is that if Hillary Clinton had been a state official rather than a federal official...
Oh, I see. Right. You wanted to make a distinction between
emails,
the two different...
From my perspective, would have been government agency records that were subject to whatever rights of access exist under the applicable Freedom of Information statute.
And then once she gives, I mean, this idea that she decided which were personal and which were government related, that seems kind of hinky too, doesn't it? I mean,
hinky. I don't know if hinky is the right word necessarily, but you know, in a lot of ways, that's why we have, and I hesitate to say this, that's why we have courts. You know, in New York, if a government agency says no, you can't have it, a court can require disclosure and engage in what is called an in-camera inspection. The court looks at the materials behind closed doors to figure out what's public and what's not. But, you know, we have...
Right, so Hillary should have just turned them over to some judge or somebody who could be objective and decide.
Well, objective, I think, is the right word.
Yeah. So moving from Hillary to something closer and something that you're involved with, the state of New York. And right now, the question is, will there be an email policy? Right, I believe right now it's only you have to hold an email for 7 months.
You know, it's a question that, in my opinion, involves what I've come to call the sin of oversimplification.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're asking.
Oh, thanks. So you're telling me I've oversimplified
you
it.
You have.
That's okay.
Again, you know, email is merely a means of communicating a record. The content under FOIL, you look at FOIL. FOIL basically says that all government agency records are available except those records or portions of records that fall within a series of exceptions. The exceptions, in my view, are based by and large on common sense.
Mm-hmm.
All the law really says, all it ever should say, is that everything is public except to the extent that disclosure would hurt either somebody
right.
in terms of an invasion of privacy.
But I thought the issue was how long you hold on to.
Well, that's a different issue.
Well, that's
a different issue, and FOIL doesn't deal with that at all. There are separate provisions of law
mm-hmm.
that deal with the retention and disposal of records. The reality is that the governor's policy is not inconsistent with law. The question is
whether it
warrants reconsideration.
Right.
And, you know, one of the realities is that all of us make mistakes. You have the 90-day email policy, and it's conceivable that some communications will be gone forever that,
hold
you
on,
know, we find out later on have become significant and perhaps
right.
should have been retained.
There, you say it already, there already is an existing policy that applies to all information. Well, it seems to me hard copy information doesn't get disposed of after 7 months. Or can it?
Again, life is complex. the State Archives is the agency that develops records retention schedules. And, you know, it started doing that, again, in the era of paper. And generally speaking, those schedules related to the significance of the records. If you called me at the office and there was a little slip on my desk, it said call so-and-so, after I returned the call, I could throw it away because, you know, that record would have no significance.
Really?
Again, the importance of the record is generally the key in terms of how long it has to be kept. I'll offer an example, and I'm not an expert on the retention schedule, but if, for example, the city council or the town board tape records its meetings, the retention schedule indicates that the tape recording has to be kept for 4 months. At the expiration of that period, it can be erased or reused or thrown out, whatever. The minutes, on the other hand, which are essentially the official record of the governing body, have to be kept permanently. And in between, you have a variety of schedules, which, again, generally relate to the importance of the records. If a record relates to a contract where the statute of limitations is 6 years, the retention schedule probably indicates that those records have to be kept for 6 years. So, again, we look at the nature and the content
right.
in so many instances to figure out.
You say the importance of the records. We look at the nature of the. Who's making this decision on the importance of the records?
Well, again, that's one of the issues that has arisen relative to the 90-day policy. Now, the policy indicates that if a state employee believes that a record may be significant, yes, it can be retained, it can be saved in another folder. But again, that is a decision that may not be made in every instance with a great deal of thought. And in some instances,
sometimes it's a matter of hindsight and you don't know that it's going to be important.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
So when we talk about the issue right now is, or that at least has gotten press, is that there's this 90-day policy or 7-month policy. Wait, now I'm getting confused myself. 7-month policy on email. And some people in the House, the State House, have called for a longer retention policy. Are you, in your position, do you take a position on this, or do you help carve out a policy, or?
Well, that depends on whether somebody asks.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in relation to that kind of issue, I have been asked. I can tell you
by
that
individual members.
Yeah. Legislation has been introduced in the Senate and the Assembly, which combines two issues. You might recall that the governor suggested that an email policy would be altered if the state legislature becomes subject to the Freedom of Information Law. Now, one of the comments that we hear all the time is that the state legislature is exempt from FOIL. Not true. Not true. Again, oversimplification. As we look at the law, again, as it applies to state and local government generally, it's based upon a presumption of access. There's a separate provision within FOIL that deals specifically with the state legislature. And instead of indicating that everything is public except, it lists categories of records that are available to the exclusion of everything else. And our office, the Committee on Open Government, has recommended on many occasions over the years that the state legislature be subject to the same kinds of disclosure requirements as the rest of government. That's what the governor asked for in the discussion of the issue, and the legislation that I'm referring to includes both elements. It includes retention requirements. It also includes a provision that would bring the state legislature within the general provisions of FOIL. I'd love to see that pass.
Those general provisions of FOIL, meaning
the provisions
the
that apply to
every
cities,
other
counties,
cities,
towns,
counties,
villages,
right.
School districts,
right.
And state agencies. Yes.
Right. Another question that comes up quite often in both in terms of local government is the open meetings. And, for example, in our own local municipality of Germantown, a fire department barred a journalist from coming into the meeting. Now, the key here was they argued that they were a volunteer fire department and therefore more like a club.
Funny thing. They're a club that I think may be behind the times. The truth is that most volunteer fire companies, and that's different from a fire district and a board of commissioners, but a volunteer fire company usually is a not-for-profit corporation that conducts its duties based upon a contract with a unit of local government. Well, there was a request made for records. In fact, this goes back to the definition of record also. Records involving a lottery that was conducted by a volunteer fire company for fundraising purposes. The request happened to have been made by a news organization in Westchester County. And the volunteer fire company said, well, we're a not-for-profit corporation. We're not covered by FOIL. See you later. Well, the case went to the state's highest court, which unanimously held, number one, that the volunteer fire company is covered by FOIL despite its status as a not-for-profit corporation. Why? Because it performs what historically has been viewed as an essential governmental function. And secondly, it wouldn't exist but for its relationship with a unit of local government. And secondly, the court looked at the nature of the records and they said, well, this has nothing to do with firefighting. But we go back to that definition of the term record. If they have them, they are covered by FOIL. Now, based upon that decision, our view has been that the governing body of a volunteer fire company is also subject to the open meetings law.
So that would hold true then for other not-for-profits that do anything related to government?
No, not necessarily.
Not all, but that do something with government.
Well, again, the point of the Court of Appeals decision was that the volunteer fire company performs what it deemed to be an essential governmental function.
Essential. So if you're out there in Germantown, you were wrong.
At least in my opinion, you'd be wrong.
Well, that's another thing. The matters of should we call it redress? When someone sent in an email talking about, in fact, he apparently followed your advice in terms of foiling information, and he got a heavily redacted transcript that shouldn't have been redacted, according to your office.
Well, I don't know. What was it?
Okay, let me dig it up here in a second.
I mean, the reality is that every record is different. And again, the content determines what's public and what's not. There are situations in which elements of records are public. Other elements clearly can be withheld.
Okay,
so what have we got?
Okay. It's I probably shouldn't use his name because I'm not sure
well,
he gave us permission. Let's see. He foiled the Chatham Central School District.
Okay.
For facility committee meeting dates and minutes, a committee that was developing a bond for 13.8.
I have a rhetorical question.
Okay.
How could a record indicating meeting dates be anything but public? Silly.
There you go.
It's plain old silly. Now, whether the entity is covered by the open meetings law is a separate question.
Mm-hmm.
If a committee is a creation of law, even if it's advisory, it's covered by the open meetings law. If a committee consists of members of a board of education, two or more, it's also covered by the open meetings law. But if, for example, the school board says, you, members of the public, I know that you've been interested in these issues. We'd like you to give us recommendations. You're going to be called the facilities committee. Well, that entity would not be subject to the open meetings law. However, again, going back to that critical definition of the term record, any information kept, held, filed, produced by, with, or for a government agency, whatever that committee produces, whatever it acquires, would constitute school district records that do fall within the scope of FOIL.
Well, I guess he felt that, originally the redactions were because I think he phrased the question poorly, shall we say. And you apparently said there shouldn't be any redactions, and what was the explanation? He requested then an individualized explanation for each redaction and got no reply. What is this?
The government agency doesn't have to do that unless it is sued and the court requires it.
Uh-huh.
The agency is required, however, to give a reason for a denial, and any time there is an initial denial of access, the applicant has the right to appeal. If the appeal is denied, the law requires that if the determination sustains the appeal, it must fully explain in writing the reasons for the denial. So what do you think was redacted here?
What they were talking about a bond issue, and apparently it was not an open meeting. He was trying to figure out what they discussed in a executive session or a closed meeting of a school board and their proposed bond.
Well, let me confuse people. Even if the open meetings law doesn't apply, FOIL does apply.
Okay.
FOIL, because of that definition of the term record, is much more expansive in its scope than is the open meetings law. That law pertains to meetings of so-called public bodies.
So apparently he's also concerned about the enforcement of these provisions. So in other words, you advised him. He went further with it.
And they still said no.
What can you do? That's what I was building up to here. What happens then? You said you can take it to a court.
We have different provisions in the two laws, in FOIL and the open meetings law.
Okay.
If under the open meetings law, assuming that that law applies, assuming that we're talking about a public body, if somebody brings a lawsuit and the court finds that substantial deliberations occurred in private that should have occurred in public, the court must award attorney's fees to John or Jane Q. Public, who has brought the suit. In addition, if those...
But if you're wrong, do you risk having to...
That's a possibility.
Yeah, right.
That's a possibility. But let's assume that he was right. Let's assume that those private deliberations that should have occurred in public were followed by some sort of a decision. Well, a court has the authority to invalidate the decision. And there's an additional penalty now, too, which some consider to be worse than death. There was a bill that was vetoed by Governor Patterson a couple of years ago that would have given a court the authority to fine public bodies for violating the open meetings law. He said no good, because in actuality the fine would be paid by the taxpayers. So they replaced that with a bill that was enacted that says that a court has the authority to order a public body to take training given by me by the Committee on Open Government. That has actually happened on a couple of occasions, and there was one school board that said, well, we'll come to Albany. And I said, I'm coming to you, and it'll be an open meeting, and anybody can be there. And, yeah, you know, the cameras were there, people like you were there, and it was an educational function. That's the whole idea. Under FOIL, it's a little bit different. If you sue under FOIL and you substantially prevail, the court has the authority, not the obligation, but the authority to award attorney's fees payable by the government if it finds either that the agency had no reasonable basis for withholding or if the agency dragged its feet unnecessarily and failed to abide by the time limitations for response that are imposed by FOIL.
So going back to his question, you know, he talks about that maybe the violators would have to take a training session and maybe the judge will void part or all of the offending policy.
Can I interject?
Well, the final question was, is there any greater recourse? I'm not sure how much
greater. Yeah, the greater recourse is that the public can vote.
Can vote, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you don't like the way people are representing you, you vote the rascals out. But I was contacted by the Chatham School District, and I was asked to do a training program for superintendents or board members, and I don't have the date, but that'll be coming up soon. So, you know, the reality is that in so many instances, you know, who's on a school board, who's on a town board? They're volunteers to a great extent.
Right.
And often they try to do the right thing, but maybe they don't have the expertise or the knowledge that they need to fully comply with law.
Can I interrupt you for a second? We have the actual emailer on the line.
Okay.
And I guess he wants to clarify his question. Let me see if we get him good on here. Oh, hello, are you there? Oh, he's here in the studio. I thought he was on the line. Okay, yeah, bring him in.
Who's the guy? Who is he?
Hello, guys.
I guess the identity is no longer secret, although you don't have to identify yourself. This is really pretty great, you know. This is pretty great. I arrived 15 minutes early and sat down with Michelle and, you know, and engaged in a conversation with her. And here we have the emailer who just walks into the studio. So this is like, you know, it's like local democracy.
That's
it's
right.
Great.
That's what
you're,
we're all about
you're
here.
Famous. We're following your fans.
Oh, my God. Please.
Do you want to identify yourself?
Yes.
Or?
Good morning. My name is Wayne Coe. I'm a parent, a district taxpayer. I've been involved in school governance and also discussions of open meeting law, which was introduced to me by a couple people who were evicted from a meeting. And one of them complained, and that got me going, well, what is open meeting law, and how does it apply here? And so I looked it up and read it.
Can I interject for a moment?
Yeah, sure.
You looked it up and read it. We, the Committee on Open Government, have a fabulous website.
You do. I have it open right
and
here.
You haven't scratched the surface, but no, it's easy to find. We're the only Committee on Open Government in the world, and if you just Google COOG or Committee on Open Government or my name, you're going to get there. And we have a ton of information that's available at your fingertips, the text of the law, frequently asked questions. There's a news page which describes
definitions of all these things.
Definitions, but most important to most people. And Mr. Coe, I assume that you looked at some of these. We write advisory legal opinions. And I'm not going to mislead. If you see an opinion you don't like it, you can throw it away and say Freeman doesn't know what he's talking about. That's your choice. The hope, of course, is that the opinions are educational, persuasive, that they encourage compliance with and knowledge of the law, and where the courts have reviewed them, they've agreed probably about 80 to 90% of the time. So the track record is pretty good. But over the course of years, and this will sound ridiculous, we've written about 25,000 opinions. They are indexed by key phrase. One index deals with the open meetings law, the other with FOIL. So in your situation, you might click on to C for committees and subcommittees.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Sure.
Mr. Coe, I think we should make it clear. Are you running for office in Chatham by any chance?
I'm not at this time, but I will probably run for school board.
Okay, we just wanted to make that clear, just so you know.
But I'm not, no.
Yeah, you're not on the board, but
no.
you might run
I'm
for
just
it.
A resident.
Okay, just want to make that clear. Sorry, Robert.
Hello, fellow district taxpayers.
That's okay,
and
that's okay.
Just had a one of the other obligations of community radio. You have to, you know, fess up to what your agenda is. But
sure.
I get it. You're just a citizen.
We're all playing fair today, right?
We're trying to. Cool.
So tell me about this committee.
Yeah, go ahead.
So
what is it?
Well,
where did
well
it come
that's the
from?
Thing. I was reading the fine print again the
yeah.
other day.
Yeah.
And I was stunned to see on the enforcement, which this is just my opinion, it seems very weak compared to the damage that can be done when you don't have an open meeting. And so here they develop this $13.8 million bond behind closed doors, evicting the public.
Who's the they?
The administration of the Chatham Central School District. So the superintendent and three board members.
And how many board members are there in total?
Nine.
So three constitute less than a majority. Let me ask you a question. Is the committee that you're talking about composed of these three members?
These three members and three staff.
Three staff.
Correct.
And the board and the committee was established how?
It was established by a policy that invited the superintendent to make a committee to write. She had to write a report for the school system, for I guess the state, about the facilities.
And
so she was authorized by the board to do this, but the board made her a delegate to the board. And in the policy, it says six times the board has ultimate responsibility. In the opening three paragraphs, six times that the board is the leader and she's a delegate. But she turned it on its head and said, it's a superintendent's committee. She is the core. She has power over these three board members."
Well, how could that be so? The three board members are elected. She is not.
That's what I think.
Well, let me ask you a question. As you just described the situation, there are six members on this committee. Three board members, three staff.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Are the three staff voting members on the committee?
Voting.
I mean, the committee presumably does what it does, offers recommendations based upon the views of a majority of its members. Right? I mean, that's the way any entity like that works.
Yeah.
I think that's what might be in the redacted information.
but that's my question, and that is critical to whether the open meetings law.
There's nothing in the policy that indicates that any board member should be on the committee, and then B, that there's any kind of voting. The committee would be.
So how does a committee make a recommendation unless there is a meeting of the minds among its members?
Well, that's the board members are the ones who come in and make
that's my question.
Which makes
sense.
That's
my question. If a committee consists of two or more board members, it is subject to the open meetings law.
But do I have to sue?
Let me finish. Okay. If, on the other hand, and there's case law, and I'm not going to tell you that it makes a heck of a lot of sense, if it is a combination. If it's three board members and two members of the public and five staff people, case law indicates that it is not covered by the open meetings law, assuming that its function is advisory in nature. So I need to know a little bit more about who the members are in fact. Now, if it's three board members and three staff who are there just to help them out, who don't vote, who really don't count in terms of this process of offering recommendations, you know, we'll reach one conclusion.
So
if the facts are different, we reach a different conclusion.
Your original request involved that meeting of those six members?
This was particularly important because they developed a $13.8 million bond. The bond was defeated, which, as you said, things can ultimately come to a vote. But I'm reading the fine print of the open meetings law, and it says, well, even if you sued and won, you can't reverse the impact of the public vote on a bond.
It doesn't say that it can't. It just says that a court doesn't have to.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But it can?
Yeah, it can.
Okay. Yeah. Then I misread it. Thank you.
Well, thanks for coming in. That
Thank
was
you.
Great.
I'm
glad we got to, you know, hear your question
this
up front.
This is more fun than I deserve.
Thank you, Mr. Coe. And there you have it. That's how, you know, anybody else who wants to call in with similar questions, you're welcome. It's 828-0290. That's interesting. So, in other words, even if a vote takes place, a judge can still invalidate
You know, and there are special rules that apply to school boards, too. If it's the city council or the town board, if it has properly entered into a so-called executive session, a portion of a meeting that can validly be closed, it may vote during the executive session. A school board can't, not because of anything the open meetings law says, but rather based upon judicial interpretations of the education law that go back to the 1950s. So a school board hardly ever can take action behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm. I like that you reminded everybody that the ultimate recourse is to vote. You know, I mean, if that's ultimately when people are playing things too close and don't let you in,
absolutely,
you vote them out.
Absolutely. You know, school board elections are coming up probably in May or June. And, you know, sadly, voter turnout in those elections is pretty minuscule. There was a guy who ran for school board in the city of Rome, New York, 50,000 people. He got 22 votes and he was elected to the board. So I've said to people, you want to make change, you want to have an impact, run for the board. Mm-hmm. If you have 8 friends, you might win.
Hmm. Well, I have another question that came in on the internet, and I'm not sure how this plays into, but it's about open meetings.
Yep.
And this listener wanted to know, are political caucuses subject to the open meeting law?
It's a sad story. political caucuses. You know, the open meetings law says that all meetings are open unless there's a basis for going into an executive session. The law lists the grounds for entry into executive session. Oh, however, at the end of the law, there are 3 exemptions. If an exemption applies, the open meetings law doesn't. It's just as though the open meetings law doesn't exist. One of the exemptions deals with political caucuses. Well, the question from the start, 1977, when the law went into effect, was, what is a political caucus? And we, the Committee on Open Government, offered opinions. They were sustained by 5 courts. And probably the best case for purposes of description involved the city of Rochester. The city council had 9 members, 8 Democrats, 1 Republican. The 8 Democrats would always hold a closed caucus before their regular meetings and discuss what they were later going to discuss at the open meetings. So the caucuses were 2 hours. The open meetings were 10 minutes. The 9th member and the Gannett newspapers got peeved and they sued and they won. And the court agreed with us. And the notion was pretty simple. If a majority of a legislative body gets together to discuss public business, it's not really a political caucus. It's really a meeting covered by the open meetings law. On the other hand, if they get together to discuss political party business, that's when the political caucus exemption applies. The open meetings law doesn't. Well, that was the law until 1985, when a reporter, then as now with the New York Post, as I understand the situation, wrote a letter to the Speaker of the Assembly, which then as now had a significant majority from one political party. And he pretty much said, unless you open your caucuses within 2 weeks, we're going to sue you. Well, instead of being sued, the state legislature changed the law virtually overnight. And since 1985, it has said that the members of a particular political party who serve in either the state Senate or the Assembly or the legislative body of a county, city, town, or village can meet in private in a closed political caucus to discuss anything, including matters of public business. So, for better or for worse, let's say that the city council has 9 members, 7 from one party, 2 from the other party. If the 7 want to get together to discuss the topic of their choice and call it a political caucus, that, for better or for worse, is legal. Whether it's good public policy is a separate question.
It's interesting because the questioner was talking about a small meeting of supervisors from the same party, whereas I know in the city of Hudson, of the 10 council, the 10 aldermen and the president, 9 are Democrats, 1's no party, and 1's a Republican, and they recently called a caucus before a meeting. And I was a little shocked by that. And I guess that it's in City Hall doesn't make a difference, right?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope. You know, that would have been consistent with law. Again, whether it's the right thing to do is a separate question.
Right. There you go.
You know, to my mind, we should rely upon what I've come to call the Spike Lee principle. Do the right thing. Yeah.
Getting back to the open meetings, you know, I've always been intrigued when I first started attending local meetings with executive session. You're on your website about executive session. You know, they will always claim litigation is the. So is it all litigation? Any litigation can go into executive session?
Well, let's put this in perspective. We look at the law, and you remember I said earlier, basically it says that everything should be open and less disclosure would hurt. Well, there is case law that goes back now, it's 35 years, where the court looked at the so-called litigation exception and said that the intent is to enable a board to discuss its litigation strategy behind closed doors so as not to divulge that strategy to the adversary, who, after all, could be out in the crowd. So that is the key. What would happen if we had to disclose? Certainly, if you, as a private person, are involved in a lawsuit, the last thing you want to do is tell your opponent what you plan to do in court. Well, a government body has the same capacity to engage in a private discussion. But the court also said that the threat, the fear, the possibility of litigation without more is not enough to justify an executive session. And how many times have we heard something like, if you don't do it my way, I'm going to sue you? Well, until a board begins to discuss what it would do in its defense in court, there would not yet be a basis for conducting an executive session.
And is that actually written on the page on your website, or is that sort of case law that
well,
supports?
Again, it's case law. You go to our advisory opinion index. You click onto L, scroll down to litigation, and you'll find lots of opinions which refer to those decisions.
Now, clearly personnel matters because they involve individuals.
It's a word that I hate, but keep going. Sorry.
Yeah, well, it's a difficult word because what happens when you're talking about union contracts?
It's a different issue.
Oh,
it's
okay.
A different issue.
And should it be open, or can it be open, or is that a strategy?
Well, let's
issue
talk
also?
About both terms that you mentioned.
Okay.
There are 8 grounds for entry into executive session. So the question always is, does the subject matter fit within one or more of those grounds? Now, one of the grounds for entry into executive session deals specifically with collective bargaining negotiations involving a public employee union. Yeah, if that's the nature of the discussion, it may be held during an executive session. And the reason, it seems to me, is clear. It's like litigation.
It's like a strategy.
You don't want to put your cards on the table
to the
disadvantage of the taxpayers. Now, you use the word personnel. When I give a presentation, often I'll yell out to the crowd, what's the favorite word that we hear for entry into executive session? And everybody yells back, personnel. Well, you look at the 8 grounds for entry into executive session. The word personnel is not there. It's not there, and yet we hear it all the time. We look at the Freedom of Information Law, and how many times have you heard or read something like, oh, it's personnel matter, it's confidential, can't talk about it. There's no law that says that. There's no law that says that. FOIL does not include the word personnel anywhere. There are some elements of personnel records that are public. There are some that can be withheld. There are some discussions involving so-called personnel matters that can be conducted in private. There are others that have to be conducted open to the public.
Some examples?
Absolutely.
Of that?
Let's say, I love this example, small school district talking about the budget. It's going on right now. And the school board says, things are pretty tight this year. Can we really afford, do we really need this art teacher position in the elementary school? Well, what if there's only one elementary school and one art teacher? Everybody's going to know whose position it is. Mm-hmm. No basis for going into an executive session. Why? Because the issue involves policy. How do we as the board choose to allocate public money? Is art really important to the education of our kids? No basis for closing the doors. On the other hand, let's say that the issue is, do we keep this teacher or can this teacher, is he or she doing a good job or a bad job? Now, in that situation, the focus in the words of the law is on a particular person. And what the law says, and I'll quote the provision, it says that a board may, and I emphasize may because it's not required, but a board may conduct an executive session to discuss, quote, the medical, financial, credit, or employment history of a particular person or corporation, or matters leading to the appointment, employment, promotion, demotion, discipline, suspension, dismissal, or removal of a particular person or corporation. So if the focus is on an employee in relation to one of those qualifiers, yes, the board then could go into executive session. But, and this is important, if the motion to discuss personnel is all that's given to the public, does anybody know? Does anybody know whether there really is a valid basis for closing the doors? We have suggested that that is not enough, and the courts have agreed with us. And what the courts have said, following our opinions, is that a motion under that provision should include two elements. Number one, inclusion of that keyword particular, so that we know that the focus is on somebody. And number two, reference to one of those qualifiers. I move to enter into executive session to discuss the employment history of a particular person or something like that. You wouldn't have to name the individual, but if the motion is that precise, what the board is really saying is, yep, we've read the open meetings law, and unless we're fibbing, we have a proper basis for closing the doors.
I wanted to ask you something else about the open meetings law and executive session. Let me just get to this page. There was something that interests me about about outsiders who could be invited into an executive session.
Uh-huh.
Who would determine
the
that?
Board. The law says...
Let's say it's a council.
The only people who have the right to attend an executive session are the members of the public body. But the law says that the board or public body or council, whatever it is, can authorize the attendance of others.
Right.
But every law, including the open meetings law, has to be carried out in a way that gives reasonable effect to its intent. And I'll tell you a story. There was a board that was talking about a parcel of land, and it went into an executive session. There were 30 people in the crowd. They invited 28 into the executive session and excluded two. Who were the two? One was a reporter. The other was a Monsignor. Why? They were talking about church property. Our advice was, if you're going to let in 28 and exclude two, it's not really an executive session. It would be unreasonable to engage in that kind of action. Now, what we have suggested is that if somebody is invited to participate in an executive session, it should be somebody who has some particular expertise or function or knowledge that is pertinent to the discussion.
So, for example, a corporate counsel.
Yeah, corporate counsel, the superintendent of schools, the staff person who has expertise relative to the area.
But not somebody who just is curious.
Not somebody who is just curious. If you're going to let in one curious person, you've got to let in everybody.
Yeah. So a lot of it does involve matters that are under litigation. Those are mostly off the table, as you said, in executive session. I just always have noticed at meetings how quickly councils, or at least our local common council, will go into executive session. And, of course, we have no idea whether they're following the intent.
Can I make a mean and nasty suggestion?
Sure.
This involves one of the rules of human nature. And I've suggested it to reporters and others many, many times over the course of years. One of the rules is that there's somebody on practically every board who's willing to spill his or her guts after the fact. It's your job to find that person.
Yeah.
And, you know, if that were a crime, God knows there would be a lot of city council members, town board members, others in jail. But they're not, at least not for that. Is it good or wise or ethical in every instance to spill your guts? Maybe not. But in most instances, it would not be contrary to law. That's why I'm loved so well by so many people out there in government. Yeah.
Well, getting back to your status in New York State government, has the Attorney General consulted you about this new retention policy that may be developed?
No.
Would you expect to be consulted by the Attorney General?
No. No, because the Attorney General really doesn't have any particular function relation to that issue. Again,
then why have they continued to chime in on this?
Because the Attorney General's office was abiding by the 90-day policy and apparently reached the conclusion that it wanted to reconsider.
Right, but he or she would have no role in forming a policy.
The AG has no particular role in relation to
advisory.
Well, again, you know, the agency that is most significant in that regard, in my opinion, is the State Archives, because the law gives the State Archives the authority to develop records retention schedules.
You know, getting back to the big story, the Hillary Clinton story, I saw something that suggested one of the problems with her email retention or using private email was that it could have been there could have been matters of national security in her emails. Now, whether that server was secure enough or not is another issue. But does issues of security ever come in any of these?
Are you talking about security meaning public safety?
Well, even Homeland Security type issues.
Well, you know, there are exceptions in the federal act which are not repeated necessarily directly in the state law. But, you know, we have provision in the New York Freedom of Information law that says that government can withhold insofar as disclosure could endanger the life or safety of any person.
Has anybody ever tried to use that on the state level?
Use that exception?
Well, use that exception in terms of, say, terrorism or national security.
Of course. After the events of 9/11, agencies reconsidered many of their policies and procedures, particularly law enforcement agencies. And there's another exception in FOIL that says that records compiled for law enforcement purposes, which if disclosed would reveal other than routine criminal investigative techniques and procedures, can be withheld. And, you know, the Court of Appeals years ago looked at that provision and said, FOIL is supposed to give the public broad rights of access, but it's not supposed to give the safe cracker the combination to the safe. Mm. And that exception would apply when disclosure could enable bad people to tailor their activities in a way in which they could evade effective law enforcement. So I think that FOIL, we don't have a national security exception, but in New York, certainly the law gives the government the ability to use common sense in withholding when disclosure is likely to cause jeopardy.
What was in my mind was a story on Democracy Now! This morning. It's a national story, not a local, not a New York State one. But the defense of somebody who was more or less entrapped into terrorism seems to be mentally challenged. But part of the defense was trying to get access to a government informant who was not a government employee per se. And, of course, they said, no, we can't tell you that informant is, even though they knew who the informant was. And so it made for a difficult defense just because they used the non-disclosure.
Understandably so, but sometimes the substance of whatever the information may be can be disclosed without disclosure of the personally identifying details.
Right.
We see that in any number of situations.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking with Robert Freeman, the executive director.
You got it right. Yes.
The COOG, and
Committee
if you wonder what
on
that means,
Open
Committee
Government.
On Open
right.
Government. And you've answered a lot of our questions, and I know it hasn't been a straight line in terms of this conversation, but I was pleased that one of our questioners actually arrived in person. I want to thank you for coming in.
Pleasure was mine.
And you clearly, I guess one of the things you want to make clear is that at the website for the COOG, you can submit questions to your office.
Anybody can write or call. The phone rings, we pick it up.
How many people you got in the office?
Two.
Oh.
Two. Chances are pretty good that you go into voicemail, but we always return the calls.
Uh-huh. So there you go. If you have questions about FOIL and the New York State rules about open meetings, and this applies to anybody. You call in. I mean, because these issues are constantly coming up. I don't know. How does someone deal with it? Just sort of, let's say you're on the spot. I guess there's really nothing you can do, right? I mean, for example, that journalist who was trying to get into that Germantown fire committee meeting.
You know, one of the suggestions that I make, and I go back to a statement offered by Judge Louis Brandeis now 102 years ago. Sunlight is the best disinfectant.
Yeah.
Sometimes, and you know this, you tell the world. And when the world finds out, either good things begin to happen or bad things stop happening.
And that's what she's done, actually, this journalist. She's made it clear to everyone, including she's a journalist, so she had the opportunity to make this clear afterwards. And I like that you use the term sunlight because they're really getting tired of the buzzword of transparency.
It's become meaningless.
It's like
awesome. Awesome used to be when your jaw dropped. Now, gee, that's an awesome tie. It doesn't mean anything anymore.
Transparent. You see through it. It doesn't sound like you see into it. You see through it or something. I don't know. Anyway, this has been another episode of We the People. And once again, we've been talking to Robert Freeman, the executive director of the Committee on Open Government. Thanks for listening.